Sports Service. Let me welcome everybody once again to Gettysburg National Military Park. My name's Ranger Carden Smith, and I'll be conducting this two-hour welcome tour covering mostly Daniel's Brigade on the afternoon of July 2nd. Afternoon of July 1st. We're going to be starting actually back by Daniel's Brigade marker, and we'll set everything up there. Then we're going to come back along Reynolds Avenue, staying between the monuments and the tall grass out there. When we get to the end of that, we're going to have to start to walk through some tall grass in order to get over to the railroad cut where I think most of the heaviest fighting in the afternoon is going to take place. And then from there, we're going to turn east and go just on the other side of the more famous railroad cut. The walk itself is about a mile and a half altogether. I do have a speaker system here, and so if at any time you have a hard time hearing me, or if the wind gets too strong and blows my voice away or something like that, this kind of give me a notice and I'll start using the speaker again. Before we go up to Daniel's Brigade marker, though, I do need two volunteers. Anybody who's willing to carry some flags?
Hey Carl, did they draw fire?
hopefully not today. That's right. At the end of this official report, Major General Robert Rhodes, commanding a division here at Gettysburg, is going to report that the conduct of General Daniel and his brigade in this most desperate engagement elicited the admiration and praise of all who witnessed it. And on this program, we hope to show why he elicited that praise from everybody. To start the program, though, we're going to come back up the hill a little bit to General Daniel's Brigade marker. And once there, we start setting everything up, and among other things, we'll explain why Daniel's Brigade is going to have a second national flag with them. But any time on the walking tour, if you have any questions, and especially at a stop, just kind of raise your hand or something, and I'll try to answer them for you. But right now, let's start the program back up at Daniel's Brigade. Can anybody hear me? Still hear me okay? All right. I'm one of those who don't think you like to use the microphone anyway. But like I said, if you do have a hard time hearing me, if the wind starts to blow my voice away, this guy give me a high sign, and I'll switch to the speaker. First of all, I'd like to set up kind of the timetable we're going to be talking about here on the afternoon of July 2nd. Robert Rhodes, I had the second on my mind for some reason. On the afternoon of July 1st, Robert Rhodes' division is going to arrive on this area at about 12 noon. The initial attacks in the afternoon are going to take place at about 2 o'clock. At roughly 2:45, Pettigrew and Pocket Grouse brigades from Hill's Corps will be launching attacks against McPherson's Ridge. At about 3:15, Juber Early's division will be launching attacks against the right flank of the Union Army 11th Corps at Barlow's Knoll. At about 3:45, Henry's division will continue the attack from McPherson's Ridge to Seminary Ridge. 3:45, Ramsroy's brigade will launch attacks from the hill. And at about 4 o'clock, Pender's division will launch attacks from McPherson's Ridge to Seminary Ridge. So we're actually talking mainly about a time period of 2 hours. This is about the length of time this program is supposed to take. Robert Rhodes himself is going to be commanding one of the largest divisions in the Confederate Army, almost 8,000 men. Now, Robert Rhodes himself was 34 years old. He was an 1848 graduate of West Point. At the beginning of the Civil War, he's appointed colonel of the 5th Alabama. He's named a brigadier general in October of 1861 and does such a good job with the brigade that in May of 1863, he's promoted to major general and given a division. And see what he can do with that. His division here at Gettysburg would consist of five brigades. Daniel with about 21, almost 2,200 men, the largest brigade in the division. The other four are commanded by Generals Iverson, Goes, Ramsdorff, and Colonel O'Neill. And Colonel O'Neill is actually commanding Rhodes' own brigade. So sometimes even here at Gettysburg, you hear the brigade referred to as Rhodes' brigade. But keep in mind, Rhodes is now a division commander. But this hasn't promoted anybody to brigadier general to take command of the brigade yet. Junius Danger himself is 35 years old. Born in North Carolina, he's an 1851 graduate of West Point. So he and Rhodes would have been at the academy together for 1 year. How well they knew each other, I'm not sure. He's going to serve with the 3rd U.S. Infantry out on frontier duty and resign in 1858. At the beginning of the Civil War, he's appointed colonel of the 14th North Carolina. Daniels himself will see action at the 7 Days campaign. He's promoted to brigadier general in September of 1862 and leads what's essentially a brand new brigade down along the coast of North Carolina. His brigade's going to consist of four regiments, the 42nd, 43rd, 45th, and 53rd North Carolina, and the 2nd North Carolina Battalion. Altogether, Daniel has about 2,162 officers and men. One of the best outfits in Daniel's brigade is going to be the 32nd North Carolina, under the command of Colonel Brabble. And you kind of want to keep that name in mind because later on we talk about another colonel getting Battle. So we've got Colonel Brabble and Colonel Battle. So we're trying to keep them straight for you. But it was said of Colonel Brabble himself that he was a strict disciplinarian, yet humane and very considerate of the comfort of his men, so that they all implicitly obeyed his orders and had entire confidence in him. And in the midst of battle, were under perfect control. The 32nd North Carolina under Colonel Brabble have been serving on duty around Petersburg, and they also took part in the unsuccessful efforts to recapture Washington and Newburgh, North Carolina. At the very beginning of the Civil War, on the battlefield of First Manassas, the Confederate Army was using what was called the First National Flag. It's actually what's now called the Stars and Bars. It was three white stripes, red, white, red, and a blue field with 7 stars. But they found in the confusion of the battle that flag looked an awful lot like a United States flag, the Stars and Stripes. So the Confederate commanders there, Beauregard and Johnston, designed the battle flag for all the Confederate units in Northern Virginia. And when Robert E. Lee took command, he issued an order that when his units went to battle, the only flag they were supposed to fly was the battle flag. They had 8 state flags they were supposed to be cased and left behind. In May of 1863, the Confederate Congress would adopt what's called the 2nd National Flag. It's simply going to be a white flag with the Confederate battle flag in the corner. Now, that's passed in May of 1863 after the Battle of Chancellorsville. There really isn't time to get manufacturers to make the flags, send them to the depots in Richmond, and then get them out to Lee's Army. So almost all the elements of Lee's Army here at Gettysburg, if they have a national flag, it's probably going to be the First National Flag. But we know at least one version of the 2nd National Flag was sent to Lee, and basically asked to give it to some well-deserving regiment. Lee is going to send the flag to General Richard Ewell, the commander of his new 2nd Corps. Ewell, in turn, sends the flag to Robert Rhodes and tells Rhodes to give it to somebody who deserves it. Rhodes supposedly was your favorite division commander. So Rhodes is going to send the flag to his favorite brigade commander, General Daniel. And Daniel, in turn, gives it to his favorite regiment, the 32nd North Carolina. And in a ceremony up in Carlisle, they present the 32nd North Carolina with the 2nd National flag. So they were probably the only unit in Lee's army with the 2nd National flag, and reportedly they carried it into battle here on the afternoon of July 1st. So the 32nd goes in with not only the battle flag, but the 2nd National flag as well. That's one reason we have both of them out here this afternoon.
Was the 32nd the Chancellorsville?
No, the 32nd is going to be down in North Carolina. How's that? Not directly with Longstreet. Longstreet is going to exercise command over the troops in North Carolina and Suffolk. They're not part of the Suffolk campaign, though.
Okay.
They're sort of on a separate mission.
Okay.
To try to recapture Newburgh.
Okay,
so they more directly fall into D.H. Hill than Longstreet. Rhodes' division, along with the Corps commander, Richard Ewell, is going to be in Carlisle by June 27th. On June 28th sometime, Ewell received orders to move on to Harrisburg. At that point, Lee wanted to have a general movement on Harrisburg to try to capture the capital of the second biggest state in the Union. And the person who was probably going to do that would be Richard Ewell. So Ewell's kind of looking forward to this. But shortly after getting those orders, sometime on the morning of June 29th, Lee decided to cancel the movement because he received information that the Union Army of the Potomac is in Frederick, Maryland, about 34 miles south of us. So rather than move on to Harrisburg, he decides to concentrate on this side of the mountains to help protect their supply lines. Lee at first designated the crossroads town of Gettysburg, and then he changed it to Cashtown, 9 miles west at the base of the mountain. So as you can imagine, General Ewell, among others, is kind of disappointed he's not moving on Harrisburg. But by the 30th, they're leaving Carlisle and coming down and heading actually towards Heidlersburg, moving over towards Biglerville, and eventually he's going to take the direct road to Cashtown. Now on the evening of June 30th, though, Ewell did receive information from General Hill that he was moving on to Gettysburg to find out what was here. Lee had given Ewell the option of either moving directly towards Cashtown or, if the situation dictated, coming here to Gettysburg. Now, Ewell at first wasn't exactly sure what the circumstances would be that would force that move. So on the morning of July 1st, Ewell is actually heading on the road towards Cashtown. But as he's making that move, he receives information from Hill that he's now engaging part of the Union Army in the area of Gettysburg. So Ewell decides those are the circumstances Lee must have been talking about. So he's going to change the direction of the move, and instead of going to Cashtown, he's going to take two parallel routes and come in the direction of Gettysburg. Robert Rhodes' division is going to turn off the road at what's now Biglerville and come down the Carlisle Road right behind us. Juba Early's division would turn off the road at Heidlersburg and come down what's now the old Harrisburg Road, Business Route 15. Rhodes himself, among other things in his official report, is going to state that when he got to within 4 miles of Gettysburg, he got kind of a surprise when he heard the volume of the fighting going on over here between Hill and the Union troops. And that's when Rhodes first became aware that there's a major battle brewing over here. 4 miles from Gettysburg, that means he has probably another 2 hours of marching time to get here. But coming down the Carlisle Road, he's going to come upon this hill. Using the trees behind us as a screen, he's going to start to come up here. He sends three brigades up here first, O'Neill, Iverson, and Daniel. Ramsdorff's brigade is going to keep behind as a reserve. And those brigades are going to be sent out onto the other side of the hill, north of the town. Because the Union Army 11th Corps had received orders to come through town and occupy this hill. And they're not going to make it because roads will be up to it. We'll have 8,000 men up here by about 12 noon. So those is going to keep the 11th Corps occupied until Jubilee can come down and hit their flank. One of the first things Rhodes is going to do is set up his artillery here on the south slope of the hill. At least two batteries totaling 8 guns. And they're going to start to fire on Union troops by the McPherson Barn about a mile south of us. Now the plain Rhodes heard here in the morning was part of the fight between Cutler and Davis's brigade on this side of the Chambersburg Road and the Hind Brigade and Archer's Brigade on the other side of the road. By 12 noon, the fighting has kind of died down in the area, and more Union troops are also coming onto the field. Bill's brigade is going to take position on the other side of the woods by the McPherson Barn. And on this side of the road, or on this side of the barn, is going to go Stone's brigade of 3 Pennsylvania regiments, the 150th, 143rd, and the 149th Pennsylvania. And initially, those 3 regiments are facing out towards the west, towards Hill's Ridge. But once Rhodes' artillery starts open fire, those regiments have to shift position. The 149th is going to move from facing west onto the Chambersburg Road, which was sort of a second road at that time, and face to the north. One reason they did that was to protect themselves from incoming artillery rounds. So long as they were all facing off to the west, the Confederate artillery can fire right down the length of the line and take out more men. By facing to the north, if an artillery round comes in, they might knock out one or two guys. So that's why they switch the position. They're still taking incoming artillery, though. And one of the targets they're aiming at, as some folks here in the beginning mentioned, were the flags of the regiment, because they're going to be the most visible thing out there. So it was decided to shift the colors of the 149 to about 50 paces to the left front of the regiment to get away from the regiment itself, to try to redirect the fire, and that's going to work. The only problem, though, is you redirect it from the main line of the infantry, and now you're directing it against the color guard instead. So the rest of the regiment probably were thankful, but I'm not sure what the color guard thought of it. Also, when Rhodes came out here, he saw Union troops moving into Wilson's Woods on our left front across the open field. And he also, of course, had the 11th Corps coming out from town. And for some reason, Rhodes became convinced that those Union troops were actually getting ready to attack him. So he's going to try to forestall that by launching his own attack. When his regiments came up here, as we mentioned, you had O'Neill over on the left, actually just on the other side of the peace light. Iverson's brigade, right about starting where we are, like Iverson's left flank will probably be right in this area, and then just down the ridge line a little bit, and behind Iverson is going to be Daniel's brigade. Daniel's left 2 regiments actually overlap Iverson's right 2 regiments. But he's going to be behind him a little bit. And Daniel also said at one point that O'Neill was on the same line as he was. So at least at first O'Neill was behind Iverson. Now, of course, the Union Army down on McPherson's Ridge isn't going to just let Rhodes fire his artillery at them. They're going to start shooting back. Now, there's a little orchard down at the bottom of the hill, about where the driveway for the peace line starts. You also had some woods over here to the right, to the west of us. There was a little gap in the woods, and then another group of woods out by the road. So Daniel and Iverson are pretty well protected by those trees. O'Neill on the left, though, is more out in the open slope. So he's going to catch most of the incoming artillery fire. Rhodes is going to order O'Neill back a little bit. He wants to detach the 5th Alabama and put them in the base of the hill to help those a little bit, and to help protect the 3rd Alabama on the right flank, Roach also shook the dad all the way over to the left flank of Daniel, and basically told the commander of the 3rd Alabama, Colonel Battle, to take orders from Daniel. To forestall this attack, though, Rose is going to give the brigade commanders up here very careful and very specific instructions on how to carry out this attack. My interpretation of it is that Rose wanted all 3 of these brigades, O'Neill, Iverson, and Daniel, to move at once. And they're all basically going to be heading south to try to break the flanks of the Union lines down here. But O'Neill, probably misunderstanding the orders, is going to move up first. And instead of attacking with all 5 regiments, he only attacked with 3. So the Union troops on Oak Ridge are able to meet that attack and throw it back. After he's thrown back, Iverson is going to start his attack. And Iverson's attack basically started out heading straight south. There's going to be a couple of things wrong with Iverson's brigade, though. The big one being that Iverson himself is not with the brigade. He's back here in the woods someplace. And he was back there either because that some of his men thought he'd had a little bit too much to drink that day, or he's back here telling his staff officers not to needlessly expose themselves to Union fire. But his brigade now is coming out here without a leader. And when they got to the 40 farm, where the lone tree is out here in front of us, instead of continuing south, they're going to turn and start to head towards Rose's Woods. Now, if they had eventually gone parallel with Oak Ridge, they probably would have been all right. But they're not doing that. They're heading in an angle towards Rose's Woods. And as they get close to the Union line down there, which they can't see, because it's behind a stone wall and behind the ridge, the Union soldiers will stand up and fire right into the flank of Iverson's men. Iverson's brigade is going to take about 89% casualties. It was the highest percentage loss of any Confederate brigade in the whole battle. But all of this is going to affect the way Daniel's brigade is going to move. Because Daniel was supposed to come in and support Iverson. When Iverson starts to move out, though, Daniel's notified they're not going the way they're supposed to. So he rode up to make a personal reconnaissance and realized that Daniel's heading, well, Iverson's heading in the wrong direction. To get a little better feel of what this land's going to be like, we're going to start heading south. And just across the Movesburg Road, we'll make a brief stop at the corner to get a little better view of Oak Ridge and where Iverson was going. Like one thing, and I've been told I've been referring to the trees right behind us as Rose's Woods. It's not Rose's Woods, it's supposed to be Wills's Woods. Actually owned by a man who's going to own what's now the Bender Farm. We're going to talk about that when you get a little further down the road. But the lone tree right behind us, over here to my right, is about where the 40 house used to stand. Now, actually, the 40 house stood there until the latter part of 1937. At that time, this particular area was not owned by the federal government or the National Park Service. And what had happened is the state of Pennsylvania Memorial Commission had actually purchased the land where the Peace Light sits now. And they wanted to create a nice vista from the Peace Light. The 40 house by that time had been abandoned. It was in a dilapidated state, in bad disrepair. And so the commission bought that house and the ground around it and promptly issued a contract to demolish it. A park historian, or actually one of the officials at the National Park Service in Washington saw this, and he said, now wait a minute, if that house is historic, maybe we should save it. Well, the park up here, so as far as they knew, the house wasn't of any historical importance. The Park Service itself didn't have the money to fix it up, and the plane was going to fall down anyway. They also sent the commissioner an over-issued contract, and they couldn't back out of the contract at this point. So sometime late 1937 or early 1938, the boarding house was torn down to make way for this vista from the Peace Lake. If you go back to the Park Visitor Center today, though, in one of the exhibit galleries over your head, you're going to see the ceiling beams from the boarding house. And right through, one reason we have those beams there is going right through the middle of them is what's probably a Union artillery shell that went right through the beams of the house and stuck in the last one that it hit. And that's on display at the Park Visitor Center. But the house stood about where that lone tree is. And it was coming down in this direction that 5th Brigade was coming. And when they got past the boarding house, they turned and started to head towards Wills' Woods. If they had hit Wills' Woods, right. I went to school in West Virginia, worked in New York, and had some good friends from New Jersey, went in California, so I might have picked up a couple different accents along the way. But the woods are the Wills' Woods. Now, if Iverson's men had actually headed straight across these fields to Oak Ridge, they probably would have been all right. But they don't do that. Instead, they angle across the fields to the woods. Baxter's brigade of Union troops was behind a stone wall back here, and as we said, that stone wall was on the edge of the drop-off. So even the flags of the brigade disappeared. That's why Iverson's men didn't know they were there. But they're going to get out here to about 100 yards or so in front of Baxter's line when Baxter's men are going to rise up and fire right into them. No skirmishers or anything. Rhodes did have some skirmishers out here, but they apparently have been pulled back. They probably fell, especially in O'Neill's front. They were too close to the front line anyway, and skirmishers wouldn't do them any good.
But Iverson did nothing on his own. Then.
Iverson did nothing on his own. Especially with O'Neill, it's sort of the same situation on July 3rd with the 27th Indiana. And the 2nd Massachusetts, they were sent across Spangler's Woods with no skirmishers in front because they thought the distance was too short to justify skirmishers. In the history of the 88th Pennsylvania, though, which is one of Baxter's regiments, they're going to report, at the command, a sheet of flame and smoke burst forth from the wall with a simultaneous crash of the rifle. Flame full in the faces of the advancing troops. The ground being quickly covered with their killed and wounded as the balls hissed and cut through their exposed ranks. We mentioned Iverson's brigade took almost 89% casualties. He started out with 1,384, and they're going to report 182 men killed, 399 wounded, and 322 missing or captured. Iverson back on the ridge line of Oak Hill, looked out here, saw his men laying in the field, and he saw a bunch of white flags go up. And he at first thought his men were just being cowards, trying to surrender. He later learned it was a lot of the wounded out here who were waving these white handkerchiefs to keep the Union troops from flying any more into the ranks.
Was there ever any disciplinary action against Iverson?
Any disciplinary action against Iverson? Well, yes and no. General Lee isn't the type to court-martial anybody, you know, if he can avoid it. So what they actually do is very quietly transfer Iverson from the Army of Northern Virginia and send him down to Georgia. Well, actually, during Sherman's Georgia campaign, he does a very good job of leading Georgia militia cavalry against Sherman's cavalry. So he does sort of make up for it. But certainly here at Gettysburg, you know, staying behind your line is not what's expected of an officer with Lee's army. So that's why they get rid of him, and Lee also eventually gets rid of O'Neill. Because part of the problem with O'Neill's troops is they were coming out here also without O'Neill. For some reason, he got behind him near the 5th Alabama. The one regiment that kind of has it easy, if you will, for Iverson's men is the 12th North Carolina. And that's because they're on the extreme right and get behind a little rise of ground for protection. And that's the only thing that saved them. Otherwise, they probably would have been decimated along with everybody else. One Confederate artillery officer, in coming off the hill the next day, looked, and going through this field, said he found a line of North Carolinians. And I think there was something like 12 had fallen backwards and 3 had fallen forwards. But what actually struck him about that line is the heels of all those men were on the same line. And to him, that was a strong indication that they had all been killed at about the same time while they were marching in formation. So that gives you an idea of the firepower coming from Baxter's line. Daniel, in coming down here now, is going to ride up personally and take reconnaissance and see what's going on. And as his brigade starts to move south, he's going to have to detach some of his regiments to help protect Iverson's men. He's going to withdraw at least 2 regiments, and at one time, the 3rd Alabama, under color of battle, also was out here trying to help stem Iverson's men and study them. What we're going to do is continue down this roadway a little bit, down to the farm lane that would go down to the Bender Farm. Once they were talking about some of these regiments being detached to help Iverson, and what Daniel's going to do with the other 3 regiments of his brigade. One thing you might want to do, though, we're going to be coming along behind the back of some of these monuments. Now, a lot of times when you're just driving through the battlefield, you look at the front of them. This time, though, take an opportunity to look at the back of some of these monuments, because there is some very interesting information on the backs of them as well. So on occasion, you might want to stop as you're driving through, get out, and see what's on the back of some of the monuments. Real quick, we've had a couple questions asked on the way down here. And one has to do with the size of brigades. Now, ideally, at the time of the Civil War, a regiment would contain about 1,000 officers and men. There's usually 3 to 4 regiments then in a brigade, 3 to 4 brigades in a division, 3 to 4 divisions in an army corps, and 2 to 7 corps made up an army. But here at Gettysburg, the average strength of a Union regiment was just over 300 men, and the average strength of a Confederate regiment was just over 320. So when you're talking about a brigade like Daniel or Iverson, you're talking about brigade strength of somewhere, usually, between about 1,300 or 1,500 men. There are some brigades that are going to be considerably bigger than that. Pettigrew's brigade, which will fight here in the afternoon of July 1st, numbered about 2,600 men. And that's because some of his units were relatively new, they hadn't seen a lot of heavy combat action, and were getting close to full strength. The 26th North Carolina, for example, had over 800 men. So that's a considerably large regiment for Lee's army in the summer of 1863. Now, by the end of the fighting on July 3rd, the 26th North Carolina is actually going to be below average strength. And anybody who's read the history of the 26th North Carolina can understand why. The other reason I wanted to stop here is, once again, to kind of talk about Iverson and where his brigade is going to be. Now, because the brigade came across at an angle, the left flank is going to be closer to the Union line than the right flank. And the right flank probably had the cover of a little rise of ground right behind me. Now, you can see it's not much of a rise of ground, but it is a dip. And that's just enough to get behind it and help protect the regiment. Eventually, then the 3rd Alabama, on the current of battle at one time, came around to the right flank of the 12th North Carolina to help support it. When Daniel started to move, of course, Colonel Battle of the 3rd Alabama thought he was going to get orders from Daniel. So he sent a staff officer order to get those orders. And Daniel appeared, didn't know anything about it, basically said, I don't have any orders to give you. This guy, come out here and do what you think is best. So the first thing Battle did was come out here to try to shore up Iverson's right flank. And then Daniel and most of his brigade is going to continue on down. So at the end of this lane, before it turns, we'll make another stop, and down there we'll talk about the regiments that Daniel detaches to help support Iverson. General Rhodes and commenting about Iverson here on the first day is going to report that Iverson's left being thus exposed, heavy loss was inflicted upon his brigade. His men fought and died like heroes. His death lay in a distinctly marked line of battle. His left was overpowered, and many of his men, being surrounded, were captured. While this was going on, we mentioned Stone's Pennsylvania Brigade down by the McPherson Farm on the other side of these woods. And at the time of the battle, the woods right here in front of us would not have been here. So that's open farmland at the time. And not only had the 149th Pennsylvania been moved over to the Chambersburg Pike, but eventually the 143rd was also moved over. So now you have two regiments on the Chambersburg Pike, essentially from where Stone Avenue is today, back to Reynolds Avenue, right along the Chambersburg Pike. The 150th, then, is the only regiment from Stone's brigade that at this time is still facing off to the west. And the 143rd and the 149th, not with Baxter's brigade, but those two regiments will also fire long range at Iverson's men. So in a sense, he was getting at one point from two directions. Although how effective the Pennsylvania shots were, I'm not sure, because that is at extreme long range, even for them. General Daniel, though, is going to report that after commencing the attack, his movement, we mentioned he did a personal reconnaissance to see what's going on out here. And he's eventually going to direct two regiments, the 43rd and the 54th North Carolina, the 43rd and the 53rd, to come out of line and come over here to help support Iverson. Now, somebody asked coming down here if Daniel was in column or in line, and he's going to be in line. Starting on the right flank of Iverson's line will be the 32nd, then the 53rd, the 43rd, the 45th, and the 2nd Battalion. With those two regiments putting out, the 2nd Battalion ended up near the center of the line somehow. Yes?
This corner of the road where it curves.
Right, he's annihilated, but he's stuck out here by himself.
So you mean the survivors had to be
Had to be supported, or else the whole brigade's going to be completely overrun. So the 3rd Alabama goes out to help support Iverson, and then these two regiments from Daniel's brigade also come out here and help support him. And they're going to be coming down along the tree line right behind me. Also, the 43rd North Carolina was ordered to support either the left flank or the right flank, as circumstances dictated. Now, we mentioned Colonel Battle of the 3rd Alabama also coming out here. At one time, he's going to pull out and head over towards the left to try to find something else to do with his regiment. And he's going to find it very shortly. Now, keep in mind, this attack is starting at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. General Henry Heath over on Hare's Ridge, and if you look behind you, you can see a blue barn with a red roof. That's the barn for Hare's Tavern. So that's Hare's Ridge out there. And General Heath is back there with, he's got two fresh brigades, Pettigrew and Brockenbrough. And when he saw Rhodes launching his attack, he wanted to do something to support it. He wanted to renew the attack against McPherson's Ridge. But there's one person back there now stopping him. Not only is the Corps Commander General Hill at the Harris Tavern, but also the Army Commander General Lee is back there as well. Now Lee, even at this point, still does not want a general engagement fought on this field until the whole Army is concentrated. So he's not going to allow Heath at first to renew his attack. Rhodes is coming down here on this attack pretty much all on his own. But about a half hour later, Lee now receives information that's going to allow him to release Heath's division to renew the attack. And that is information that Juba Early is now coming down the Harrisburg Road and getting into position to attack the right flank of the Union Army 11th Corps and the right flank of the Union line. So now he's going to release Pettigrew and Blankenbrough off of Hill's Ridge to try to attack the Union line on McPherson's Ridge. That's going to be going on while Daniel still continues to press south with the three regiments he has over here. The 2nd Battalion, the 53rd, and the 32nd North Carolina still on the right flank. And they're going to be passing through Pearl of the Farm right behind us. And let me make sure I get this name right. Today it's the Bender Farm. At the time, though, it was owned by the same man who owned the woods behind us, James J. Wills. Okay? So Mr. Wills owns the farm, but at the time, we don't think he was actually living there. We actually think he had it rented out to William Joe, who was part of the free black community here in Gettysburg. Now, the present barn back there dates back to 1860, so that was here at the time of the battle. The house itself to the right dates to 1868. So the barn was here, but not the house. But some of the commanders of Daniel's brigade reported stopping in a farm lane. And the only farm lane in this area is the one going back to the Bender Farm. So they used that lane to make a left flank move to come over here to help support Iverson. Meanwhile, the other three regiments continued heading south on the other side of these trees. Now, since those trees are a little thick to try to go through, what we're going to do is make a left here, and then just on the other side of the trees, we're going to cut to the south and go down to the railroad cut that I think saw some of the heaviest fighting here on July 1st.
If you were on the extreme left flank of Daniel's three regiments,
right,
how far would the front be to the other end?
Daniel's whole front in line was about 1,300 feet from one end to the other when he started. Yeah, so right. The 32nd North Carolina is probably down, initially down by the foreign buildings themselves.
How much space would we have expected to see between them?
Between the regiments?
Yeah.
Normally, I think between regiments, they're talking about 5 or 10 paces. So there is a little gap. But that's what the tactics manual says if you're at full strength. So remember, at full strength, a regiment's going to be 1,000 men. When you've got a regiment that's maybe half that, you probably don't have the spacing between the regiments. They're probably marching down here regiment by regiment. But one's going to pull out, and then the second one will pull out, come down the farm lane, and take position on the right flank of Iverson's brigade.
Right, the railroad cut directly across from the visitor center.
Talking about here, we had a question asked, when Daniel's men were coming down, are they going to have loaded rifles? And the answer is probably once he had them in line and was getting ready to move, he's going to load the rifles. Now, we don't have specific information about that, but I suspect he's going to load before he starts to move. The other example we were given, it has to do with the Iron Brigade, which fought over in Grips Woods behind us on the morning of July 1st. Now, the Iron Brigade first came into position back on Seminary Ridge, and they had first stopped to load their guns. But they were given orders, you don't have time to do that, you're going to have to load on the run. And the Iron Brigade then stepped off at a double quick, which is a 33-inch step measured between 165 and 190 steps per minute. So they're doing a quick job, which means they're doing that, loading their guns, and trying to stay in formation at the same time. And they did all that. So that gives you an idea of how well-trained and well-disciplined the Iron Brigade was compared to some other units on the field, that they were able to do that. Right now, right behind me, and you'll be able to see this when we go up to the east here, is the first of three railroad cuts in this ridgeline. There's one right here behind us. The more famous one is just to the east of us. And the third railroad cut through Oak Ridge and Seminary Ridge is behind Larson's Motel, a little further east of us, right on top of the ridge. And even though the middle cut is probably the more famous one, that's where we had the fight between the 2nd Mississippi and the 6th Wisconsin on the morning of July 1st, I think that this cut right behind us probably is going to see more action.
What is the railroad cut?
The railroad cut is simply a cut through the ridges. Now, the line itself had been laid out. The cuts had been made before the Civil War, but by the summer of 1863, the tracks themselves haven't been laid. So it's just a cut. There's no trains running through here or anything. They're actually not going to lay the tracks for this railroad until something like 20 years after the battle. And actually at the time, the company that laid these had actually gone bankrupt, I believe. So somebody else is going to have to come along and lay it. In 1863, the only train and rail line coming into Gettysburg was from Hanover from the east. And that's it. Only one rail line coming into town. It did have a lot of roads coming into it, just like today. And that's one reason why both armies now are coming in the direction of Gettysburg, because of the road network. Lee can use it to concentrate his army, and the Union Army could follow it to relieve pressure on Harrisburg. That's why they were initially coming north on July 1st. The fighting, even though it's going to be pretty fierce, also gets a little confusing because you have a lot of movement back and forth going on here. So I'm going to try to go through it and then at the end try to summarize all the different actions that's taking place here. One of the first things that's going to happen is the 149th had sent a skirmish line about 75 yards out here in front of us, right near the rise of ground. And the horse was apparently a fence up there at the same time. The 2nd North Carolina Battalion and the 45th are going to be coming down this direction. And the commander of the 45th said they were doing a good advance against the stone barn behind us at the McPherson Barn. And he said the only thing that stopped them was this railroad cut. Because coming down here, they probably didn't know the cut was here. You want to keep in mind that none of the guys fighting here had ever been here before. General Lee and his senior commanders had some good maps of the area. They may have shown the rail line coming through here, but it wouldn't actually have shown the cut itself. So if you're coming down from the north and have never been here before, all of a sudden you're making good progress. There's some tall grass here, and the next thing you know, you're down to the bottom of the railroad cut. Or as one commander said, his men went to ground. The 149th now is going to charge from the Chambersburg Road out here to recapture the cut and force these men back. They're going to try to come back again. The Carolinians are going to try to come back again.
And this time, the Pennsylvanians who were in a single line here had the guns resting on top of the bank of the railroad cut. And they're going to open fire at very short range and drive them back again. Back behind the cover of the hill. The 32nd North Carolina, or excuse me, the 2nd North Carolina Battalion was out here to the left a little bit. And just past here, the ground starts to even out a little bit.
Still our left is right.
And they advanced up there and found themselves being fired on by the 143rd Pennsylvania up near Reynolds Avenue. And the 143rd was actually firing oblique, a left oblique, down the line. They're also coming under fire from Stuart's artillery placed on Oak Ridge, just about where Marsh Motel is today, actually right in front of it. So they've got all that going on as well. Finally, they're going to fall back behind the ridge line for some more safety. And one veteran of the 2nd Battalion reported that the men who had behaved like veterans so far became temporarily demoralized. Then it was that the soldier loomed up and plucked the fire safely out of the knee of danger. Junius Daniel is the man referred to. In his stentorian tones, audible in command for a quarter of a mile or more away, he ordered the men to halt and reform on him. This they did without regard to company or regimental formation. Almost to a man, advanced at once. So they're going to try to advance again against the railroad cut. The 45th North Carolina again manages to get here and force the Pennsylvanians out of the cut. But then the Pennsylvanians are going to mount a counterattack and come back. Meanwhile, Colonel Brabble of the 32nd North Carolina over here to our right was trying to come around as well. Now, by that time, Pettigrew and Blackenbrow are advancing against McPherson's Ridge. This is about 2:45 in the afternoon. And Bramble reported, and actually even General Ewell reported, that there was a brigade from Hill's Corps on the other side that Bramble wanted to get assistance from, and he couldn't do it. Now, Blackenbrow's brigade has about 900 men in it, but apparently there's some problem with the morale of the brigade even to start with. Because the 149th Pennsylvania was facing this direction, the 143rd facing this direction, and in the 150th Pennsylvania, they actually took three regiments and also aimed them in this direction. Three companies. Did I say three regiments? Three companies, not three regiments. Three companies from the 150th came facing this direction, which meant you only have seven companies from the 150th that's doing with Blackenbrow's brigade, and that's it. The damage being done along McPherson's Ridge is not by Blackenbrow, but by Pettigrew's brigade of almost 2,600 men. And Pettigrew's brigade are going to sweep McPherson's Ridge and drive the Iron Brigade and Bill's Brigade out the ridge back to Seminary Ridge. But Colonel Brown was getting no help from Blackenbrow. When he tried to go over low ground, just to the west of us, the 150 would start to open fire, and those three companies then mount a bayonet charge against the 32nd North Carolina and drive it back, while these regiments are also being driven back. What Bramble's going to have to wait for is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, Pettigrew and Blackenbrow launched their attacks about 2:45, about 3:15, Juber Early is now in position to attack the right flank of the 11th Corps, and they start to fall back. At 3:45, Rhodes renewed his attack against Oak Ridge with Ramsworth's brigade, and Ramsworth now would start to collapse that into the line. At 4 o'clock, Pender's division from Hill's Corps would start to move off Hill's Ridge to McPherson's Ridge and press the attack to Seminary Ridge. That's going to allow Colonel Brabble of the 32nd North Carolina to come across the railroad further down, align his regiment on the railroad cut, and then start to push east. The 45th North Carolina and the 2nd Battalion also line along the railroad cut and start to push east against Oak Ridge. To kind of summarize what happened here then, is first of all, you have the 2nd and 45th North Carolina reach a rail fence about 75 yards east, or 75 yards north of where we are right now. The 149th and 143rd open fire along with Stewart's Battery. There's going to be the 149th were counterattack towards the cut and beyond it. The 2nd and 45th then advance again, reach the rail fence, and they're met by volleys from the 149th. And then the North Carolinians were actually aided by the Lutch artillery from Hill's Corps, which is going to come down within canister range and start to sweep the railroad cut. So they have that help as well. The 45th gets into the cut. The 2nd Battalion, we mentioned, got into the shallow, and they're fired on by the 143rd. Then the 32nd North Carolina is sit by the right flank. We mentioned the 150th in a bayonet charge and driven back. And the 149th charges again to recapture the cut. Pender is going to advance from the west, and then Pender advanced after him. And that's when the railroad cut is finally clear. Is that clear as milk to everybody? Or clear as mud? They're going to start to fall back as best they can, but what they found was once the Iron Brigade was pushed out of McPherson's Ridge, their flanks exposed. And of course, now you've got Pender coming up, you got Daniel coming down from here, and it's just too much pressure. So they're going to have to fall back. They don't fall back in a rout, they fall back as best they can. The color bear of the 143rd Pennsylvania is going to stop where the monument is at the intersection of Chambersburg Road and Rhodes Avenue. And on the monument, he's depicted holding the flag in one hand and going like this. He turned around to shake his fist at the oncoming Confederates before he was actually shot and killed. And somebody else would grab the flag and carry it back into town. The commander of the brigade was Colonel Stone. This was Stone's Bucktails Brigade. Or as the 1st Pennsylvania Reserves called them, the Bogus Bucktails. Stone had belonged to the 1st Pennsylvania Reserves, which was also called the Bucktails. And they got that nickname because they wore bucktails in their hats. So when Stone took command of this brigade, he also had these guys wearing bucktails in their hats, and known as the Bucktail Brigade. But as you can imagine, the original Bucktails didn't like it. So that's why they call these guys the Bogus Bucktails. Okay? But they're going to do some good fighting here on July 1st nonetheless. It is a good unit. Yes?
In the back and forth, was it each side catching the other within the cut and firing down into the cut as it was in the early morning?
Well, one of the things that's going to happen is you've got the 149th in the cut itself when Daniel starts to advance. And they're laying their guns right on the edge of the cut and firing. And actually, at one point, the commander of the 149th said he fired. And he essentially said that Daniel's men were so close, the muzzles were almost touching them before he opened fire. So that's about as close to the range as you can get. The trouble with the cut is that it's deep. And once the men were on this side of the cut, it's hard to climb out of it. And it's also hard to climb down and then up the other side. That's one of the problems. That's why when the 45th North Carolina hit this, they were able to drive out the 149, but then they couldn't climb up the other side of it. And that's when they're countercharged by the 149. So you have this back and forth movement over the cut. If it wasn't for this cut, Daniel's men would have come straight down, and I don't think there's too much that maybe would have stopped them at that point. Because unlike Iverson and O'Neill, these three regiments have Daniel right behind them, directing the movements. So in this case, you have the brigade commander actually on the field doing a personal reconnaissance before they start, and then directing each of the regiments where to go. So he's right on the field to direct everything. That's one thing that sets Daniel apart from maybe Iverson and O'Neill. You're welcome. Any other questions before you leave the railroad cut? They've never seen that flag before. I've never seen any accounts, though, from Stone's brigade talking about seeing a white flag out here. If they did see it, they probably didn't know what it was and didn't affect them at all. Now, one thing with the 149th that is going to happen, when they pulled out of here under this pressure, somebody forgot to tell the color guard they were leaving. So they left the color guard out there, and the flag was captured by one of the Confederate units coming up here. But the color guard, some of the men in the color guard went down trying to protect it. I think what happened is Union regiments usually had two flags. They had a national flag and a state flag. And I believe they were able to get one flag out, the Confederates captured the other flag. What I'd like to do is move east along this, along the cut itself, so you can kind of get a view of it. You can see how it bends down into some flat ground, and then we'll go across Rhodes Avenue to the other side of the middle cut. We're talking about Daniels at the end of the day, and where Daniels is going to end up on July 3rd.
Pennsylvania regiments only had one flag. Only had one flag, and in the part they put the state seal on it.
Was it the national flag?
That's the national flag. The
Once again, to try to set the time frame here, the battle on July 1st opened at 10 o'clock in the morning. Actually, the infantry fight started at 10 o'clock in the morning with the fight between Davis and Cutler on this side and the Iron Brigade and Archer's Brigade on the other side of the road. As we mentioned, the most famous cut here is the one read right now. And this is the cut where you have the fight between the 2nd Mississippi and the 6th Wisconsin. The fighting here dies out by 12 noon. Robert Rhodes with his division is back up on Oak Hill, about a mile, almost a mile north of us. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Rhodes will start his attack with O'Neill, Iverson, and Daniel. At 2:45, Pettigrew launches his attack. At 3:15, Gilbert Early attacks on the other side of these trees in the valley north of Gettysburg. At 3:45, Ramsdorff will launch his attacks that end up at the north end of Oak Ridge, right above us. And then at 4 o'clock, Pender's division will renew their attack from McPherson's Ridge up to Seminary Ridge over here to your right rear. And you can see the steeple in the cupola of the Lutheran Seminary today. Stuart's battery that was flying at Daniel's battery one time is going to be located where you see these trees to your right of the railroad itself. Now, he actually had some guns over there and some guns on this side of the railroad cut as well. And those are the guns flying on part of Daniel's brigade coming down. We mentioned, though, that Colonel Bramble with the 32nd North Carolina eventually aligned himself on the other side of the railroad cut with Pender's division, especially with Scales' brigade, and started to push east on that side of the railroad cut. The 45th and the 2nd Battalion aligned themselves on this side and started to move east against Oak Hill right behind us. And they're going to be joined, we said, over here on the north by Ramsdorff's brigade, the 3rd Alabama under Colonel Battle, and elements of what's left of Iverson and O'Neill's brigade. Essentially, what was happening between 3:15 and 4 o'clock was a Confederate advance all along the length of the Union line, from Barlow's Knoll all the way over to Fairfield Road. But it wasn't, in a sense, a coordinated attack. Robert E. Lee had been sitting back on Hill's Ridge, trying to figure out where these elements are going to come out in the field and when he can send them across. He's going to let these attacks come up pretty much on their own, on their own timing. But the effect of it is an attack all along the length of the line. And that's what's going to collapse the Union defense here and send them back through town. General Ewell mentioned in his official report that seeing some troops of the 3rd Corps lying down beyond the railroad in front of the enemy who were on his flank, General Daniels sent an officer to get them to advance. Now here he's probably talking about Blackenbrough's brigade. As they would not, he was obliged to change the front of the rest of his brigade to the rear and throw part across the railroad beyond the cut. We're having formed line directly in front of the troops of the 3rd Corps, already mentioned, he ordered an advance of his whole brigade. So now the whole brigade is advancing against Oak Ridge behind us, and made a charge on the woods in our front, capturing 188 prisoners in this place. He's talking about the woods right behind us along Oak Ridge, and that's why he's captured almost 188 Union prisoners. First Corps prisoners. You have the 1st Corps along Oak Ridge and Seminary Ridge itself. The 11th Corps is going to be north of town. Basically, the left flank will be at what's now Gettysburg College, and the right flank will be at Bowler's Knoll. The 11th Corps had about 6,000 men out there. The 1st Corps in the morning had about 10,000 men. So by this time in the afternoon, there's somewhere between probably 14,000 and 18,000 Union troops. The Confederates will be able to mass about 24,000. So they're going to have the advantage in numbers at this point. But the Confederates succeed in driving the Union forces off Oak Ridge behind us and eventually off Seminary Ridge to the south of us and start to drive them back through the town. Daniel's men, for the most part, though, are going to be halted at Oak Ridge. And the rest of the Confederate Army would take up the pursuit after that. On the morning of July 2nd, he's going to be shifted to the other side of the railroad cut. And then early in the morning of July 3rd, he's going to be sent through town to the other side to a place called Culp's Hill. And just through the railroad cut, you can make out sort of the slope of Culp's Hill itself. And that's where he's going to do some more fighting on July 3rd. All together in the fighting of the 2,162 men of Daniel's brigade, he's going to report at least 950 casualties, almost 44%. Colonel Bradley of the 32nd North Carolina reported he had 78 casualties, none reported prisoners. So those 78 were either killed or wounded on the field. Daniel did report about a third of his casualties occurred on July 1st. In the 45th North Carolina, you had reported that Lieutenant George Borey and W.E. Harris were killed. Captain P.P. Scales was mortally wounded. Lieutenant Colonel S.H. Borey was wounded, and Lieutenant Samuel Adams was wounded, but refused to leave the field. And he's going to stay with his company during the fight. The 2nd North Carolina Battalion, which took the hardest hits here on July 1st, reported almost two-thirds casualties in this fighting on July 1st. Lieutenant Colonel Anderson of the battalion was killed after having received already one wound for staying in the fight with his battalion. Since Daniel's men fought at Culp's Hill on the third day, it's kind of hard to get a specific number of casualties here on the first day. But altogether, the regiments in the brigade are going to report in the 32nd North Carolina 181 casualties, the 43rd, 187. Total casualties for the 45th and 53rd North Carolina were unrecorded. All they recorded were the number of killed. 63 in the 45th and 46 in the 53rd. And the 2nd North Carolina Battalion which came in with 240 officers and men, reported almost 200 casualties in 2 days of fighting. General Daniel, in concluding his section of the report on the first day of Scarlet State, that I feel it my duty at this point to make mention of the gallant conduct of my troops during this action. Their loss in killed and wounded amounted to about one-third the number that entered the fight. All acted with courage and coolness, but it fell to the lot of the 45th, 2nd Battalion, and 32nd to meet the heaviest efforts of the enemy. This they did in the most gallant manner, repulsing them at every advance and by driving them in confusion from the field. And I think from what we've experienced here this afternoon and from Daniel's report, we can understand why Daniel was probably Rhodes' favorite brigade and why the 32nd North Carolina was given the honor of having the first national flag in Lee's Army. I want to thank everybody for joining me this afternoon on the walking tour. I'll be here for a few minutes in case you have any questions. For those of you who want to head back to your cars, you can stay on the path here to the north. There is a place, though, where you can probably cut across the field and get up to the peace light. Once again, I want to thank everybody for coming out with me today and for coming to Gettysburg.